At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
With Robinhood, not only can you trade individual stocks and ETFs, you can also seamlessly buy and sell crypto at low costs. Trade all in one place. Get started now on Robinhood.
Trading crypto involves significant risk. Crypto trading is offered through an account with Robinhood Crypto LLC. Robinhood Crypto is licensed to engage in virtual currency business activity by the New York State Department of Financial Services. Crypto held through Robinhood Crypto is not FDIC insured or SIPC protected. Investing involves risk, including loss of principal. Securities trading is offered through an account with Robinhood Financial LLC, member SIPC, a registered broker-dealer.
The Moon Metal, Chapter 1. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. The Moon Metal, by Garrett P. Service. Read by Betsy Bush, in Marquette, Michigan, June 2007. Chapter 1. South Polar Gold. When the news came of the discovery of gold at the South Pole, nobody suspected that the beginning had been reached of a new era in the world's history. The newsboys cried extra, as they had done a thousand times for murders, battles, fires, and Wall Street panics, but nobody was excited. In fact, the reports at first seemed so exaggerated and improbable that hardly anybody believed a word of them. Who could have been expected to credit a dispatch forwarded by cable from New Zealand and signed by an unknown name, which contained such a statement as this: "A seam of gold which can be cut with a knife has been found within 10 miles of the South Pole." The discovery of the pole itself had been announced 3 years before, and several scientific parties were known to be exploring the remarkable continent that surrounds it. But while they had sent home many highly interesting reports, there had been nothing to suggest the possibility of such an amazing discovery as that which was now announced. Accordingly, most sensible people looked upon the New Zealand dispatch as a hoax. But within a week, and from a different source, flashed another dispatch, which more than confirmed the first. It declared that gold existed near the South Pole in practically unlimited quantity. Some geologists said this accounted for the greater depth of the Antarctic Ocean. It had always been noticed that the southern hemisphere appeared to be a little overweighted. People now began to prick up their ears, and many letters of inquiry appeared in the newspapers concerning the wonderful tidings from the south. Some asked for information about the shortest route to the new gold fields. In a little while, several additional reports came, some via New Zealand, others via South America, and all confirming in every respect what had been sent before. Then a New York newspaper sent a swift steamer to the Antarctic, and when this enterprising journal published a 4-page cable describing the discoveries in detail, all doubt vanished and the rush began. Sometime I may undertake a description of the wild scenes that occurred when, at last, the inhabitants of the northern hemisphere were convinced that boundless stores of gold existed in the unclaimed and uninhabited wastes surrounding the South Pole. But at present I have something more wonderful to relate. Let me briefly depict the situation. For many years, silver had been absent from the coinage of the world. Its increasing abundance rendered it unsuitable for money, especially when contrasted with gold. The silver craze, which had raged in the closing decade of the 19th century, was already a forgotten incident of financial history. The gold standard had become universal, and business all over the world had adjusted itself to that condition. The wheels of industry ran smoothly, and there seemed to be no possibility of any disturbance or interruption. The common monetary system prevailing in every land fostered trade and facilitated the exchange of products. Travelers never had to bother their heads about the currency of money. Any coin that passed in New York would pass for its face value in London, Paris, Berlin, Rome, Madrid, St. Petersburg, Constantinople, Cairo, Khartoum, Jerusalem, Peking, or Yeddo. It was indeed the Golden Age, and the world had never been so free from financial storms. Upon this peaceful scene, the South Polar gold discoveries burst like an unheralded tempest. I happened to be in the company of a famous bank president when the confirmation of those discoveries suddenly filled the streets with yelling newsboys. "Get me one of those extras," he said, and an office boy ran out to obey him. As he perused the sheet, his face darkened. "I'm afraid it's too true," he said at length. "Yes, there seems to be no getting around it. Gold is going to be as plentiful as iron. If there were not such a flood of it, we might manage. But when they begin to make trouser buttons out of the same metal that is now locked and guarded in steel vaults, where will be our standard of worth? My dear fellow," he continued, impulsively laying his hand on my arm, "I would as willingly face the end of the world as this that's coming." "You think it so bad, then?" I asked. "But most people will not agree with you. They will regard it as very good news." "How can it be good?" he burst out. "What have we got to take the place of gold? Can we go back to the age of barter? Can we substitute cattle pens and wheat bins for the strong boxes of the treasury? Can commerce exist with no common measure of exchange?" "It does indeed look serious," I assented. "Serious? I tell you it is the deluge!" Thereat he clapped on his hat and hurried across the street to the office of another celebrated banker. His premonitions of disaster turned out to be but too well grounded. The deposits of gold at the South Pole were richer than the wildest reports had represented them. The shipments of the precious metal to America and Europe soon became enormous, so enormous that the metal was no longer precious. The price of gold dropped like a falling stone, with accelerated velocity, and within a year every money center in the world had been swept by a panic. Gold was more common than iron. Every government was compelled to demonetize it, for when once gold had fallen into contempt, it was less valuable in the eyes of the public than stamped paper. For once, the world had thoroughly learned the lesson that too much of a good thing is worse than none of it. Then somebody found a new use for gold by inventing a process by which it could be hardened and tempered, assuming a wonderful toughness and elasticity without losing its non-corrosive property, and in this form it rapidly took the place of steel. In the meantime, every effort was made to bolster up credit. Endless were the attempts to find a substitute for gold. The chemists sought it in their laboratories, and the mineralogists in the mountains and deserts. Platinum might have served, but it too had become a drug in the market through the discovery of immense deposits. Out of the 20-odd elements which had been rarer and more valuable than gold, such as uranium, gallium, etc., not one was found to answer the purpose. In short, it was evident that since both gold and silver had become too abundant to serve any longer for a money standard, the planet held no metal suitable to take their place. The entire monetary system of the world must be readjusted, but in the readjustment it was certain to fall to pieces. In fact, it had already fallen to pieces. The only recourse was to paper money, but whether this was based upon agriculture or mining or manufacture, it gave varying standards, not only among the different nations, but in successive years in the same country. Exports and imports practically ceased. Credit was discredited, commerce perished, and the world, at a bound, seemed to have gone back, financially and industrially, to the Dark Ages. One final effort was made. A great financial congress was assembled at New York. Representatives of all the nations took part in it. The ablest financiers of Europe and America united the efforts of their genius and the results of their experience to solve the great problem. The various governments all solemnly stipulated to abide by the decision of the Congress. But after spending months in hard but fruitless labor, that body was no nearer the end of its undertaking than when it first assembled. The entire world awaited its decision with bated breath, and yet the decision was not formed. At this paralyzing crisis, a most unexpected event suddenly opened the way. End of chapter 1.
This recording is in the public domain.
The Moon Metal, Chapter 2. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. The Moon Metal by Garrett P. Service. Read by Betsy Bush in Marquette, Michigan, June 2007. Chapter 2. The Magician of Science. An attendant entered the room where the perplexed financiers were in session and presented a peculiar-looking card to the president, Mr. Boone. The president took the card in his hand and instantly fell into a brown study. So complete was his absorption that Herr Finster, the celebrated Berlin banker, who had been addressing the chair for the last 2 hours from the opposite end of the long table, got confused, entirely lost track of his verb, and suddenly dropped into his seat, very red in the face, and wearing a most injured expression. But President Boone paid no attention except to the singular card, which he continued to turn over and over, balancing it on his fingers, and holding it now at arm's length, and then near his nose, with one eye squinted as if he were trying to look through a hole in the card. At length, this odd conduct of the presiding officer drew all eyes upon the card, and then everybody shared the interest of Mr. Boone. In shape and size, the card was not extraordinary, but it was composed of metal. What metal? That question had immediately arisen in Mr. Boone's mind when the card came into his hand, and now it exercised the wits of all the others. Plainly, it was not tin, brass, copper, bronze, silver, aluminum, although its lightness might have suggested that metal, nor even base gold. The president, although a skilled metallurgist, confessed his inability to say what it was. So intent had he become in examining the curious bit of metal that he forgot it was a visitor's card of introduction, and did not even look for the name which it presumably bore. As he held the card up to get a better light upon it, a stray sunbeam from the window fell across the metal, and instantly it bloomed with exquisite colors. The president's chair being in the darker end of the room, the radiant card suffused the atmosphere about him with a faint rose tint, playing with surprising liveliness into alternate canary color and violet. The effect upon the company of clear-headed financiers was extremely remarkable. The unknown metal appeared to exercise a kind of mesmeric influence, its soft hues blending together in a chromatic harmony which captivated the sense of vision, as the ears are charmed by a perfectly rendered song. Gradually all gathered in an eager group around the president's chair. "What can it be?" was repeated from lip to lip. "Did you ever see anything like it?" asked Mr. Boone for the 20th time. None of them had ever seen the like of it. A spell fell upon the assemblage. For 5 minutes no one spoke, while Mr. Boone continued to chase the flickering sunbeam with the wonderful card. Suddenly the silence was broken by a voice which had a touch of awe in it. "It must be the metal!" The speaker was an English financier, First Lord of the Treasury, Honorable James Hampton Jones, KCB. Immediately everybody echoed his remark, and the strain being thus relieved, the spell dropped from them, and several laughed loudly over their momentary aberration. President Boone recollected himself, and coloring slightly, placed the card flat on the table, in order more clearly to see the name. In plain red letters it stood forth with such surprising distinctness that Mr. Boone wondered why he had so long overlooked it. Dr. Max Six. "Tell the gentleman to come in," said the president, and thereupon the attendant threw open the door. The owner of the mysterious card fixed every eye as he entered. He was several inches more than 6 feet in height. His complexion was very dark, his eyes were intensely black, bright, and deep-set. His eyebrows were bushy and upcurled at the ends. His sable hair was close-trimmed, and his ears were narrow, pointed at the top, and prominent. He wore black mustaches covering only half the width of his lip and drawn into projecting needles at each side, while a spiked black beard adorned the middle of his chin. He smiled as he stepped confidently forward with a courtly bow, but it was a very disconcerting smile, because it more than half resembled a sneer. This uncommon person did not wait to be addressed. "I have come to solve your problem," he said, facing President Boone, who had swung round on his pivoted chair. "The metal!" exclaimed everybody in a breath, and with a unanimity and excitement which would have astonished them if they had been spectators instead of actors of the scene, the tall stranger bowed and smiled again. "Just so," he said. "What do you think of it?" It is beautiful. Again, the reply came from every mouth simultaneously, and again, if the speakers could have been listeners, they would have wondered not only at their earnestness, but at their words. For why should they instantly and unanimously pronounce that beautiful, which they had not even seen? But every man knew he had seen it, for instinctively their minds reverted to the card and recognized in it the metal referred to. The mesmeric spell seemed once more to fall upon the assemblage, for the financiers noticed nothing remarkable in the next act of the stranger, which was to take a chair, uninvited, at the table, and the moment he sat down, he became the presiding officer as naturally as if he had just been elected to that post. They all waited for him to speak, and when he opened his mouth, they listened with breathless attention. His words were of the best English, but there was some peculiarity which they had already noticed, either in his voice or his manner of enunciation, which struck all of the listeners as denoting a foreigner. But none of them could satisfactorily place him, neither the Americans, the Englishmen, the Germans, the Frenchmen, the Russians, the Austrians, the Italians, the Spaniards, the Turks, the Japanese, or the Chinese at the board could decide to what race or nationality the stranger belonged. "This medal," he began, taking the card from Mr. Boone's hand, "I have discovered and named. I call it artemisium. I can produce it in the pure form, abundantly enough to replace gold, giving it the same relative value that gold possessed when it was the universal standard." As Dr. Six spoke, he snapped the card with his thumbnail, and it fluttered with quivering hues, like a hummingbird hovering over a flower. He seemed to await a reply, and President Boone asked, "What guarantee can you give that the supply would be adequate and continuous?" "I will conduct a committee of this Congress to mine in the Rocky Mountains, where, in anticipation of the event, I have accumulated enough refined artemisium to provide every civilized land with an amount of coin equivalent to that which is formerly held in gold. I can then satisfy you of my ability to maintain the production." "But how do we know that this metal of yours will answer the purpose?" "Try it," was the laconic reply. "There is another difficulty," perused the president. "People will not accept a new metal in place of gold unless they are convinced that it possesses equal intrinsic value. They must first become familiar with it, and it must be abundant enough and desirable enough to be used sparingly in the arts, just as gold was." "I have provided for all that," said the stranger, with one of his disconcerting smiles. "I assure you that there will be no trouble with the people. They will be only too eager to get and to use the metal. Let me show you." He stepped to the door and immediately returned with two black attendants bearing a large tray filled with articles shaped from the same metal as that of which the card was composed. The financiers all jumped to their feet with exclamations of surprise and admiration, and gathered around the tray, whose dazzling contents lighted up the corner of the room where it had been placed as if the moon were shining there. There were elegantly formed vases, adorned with artistic figures, embossed and incised, and glowing with delicate colors which shimmered in tiny waves with the slightest motion of the tray. Cups, pins, finger rings, earrings, watch chains, combs, studs, lockets, medals, tableware, models of coins, in brief. Almost every article in the fabrication of which precious metals have been employed was to be seen there in profusion, and all composed of the strange new metal, which everybody on the spot declared was far more splendid than gold. "Do you think it will answer?" asked Dr. Six. "We do," was the unanimous reply. All then resumed their seats at the table, the tray with its magnificent array having been placed in the center of the board. This display had a remarkable influence. Confidence awoke in the breasts of the financiers. The dark clouds that had oppressed them rolled off, and the prospect grew decidedly brighter. "What terms do you demand?" at length asked Mr. Boone, cheerfully rubbing his hands. "I must have military protection for my mine and reducing works," replied Dr. Six. Then I shall ask the return of 1% on the circulating medium, together with the privilege of disposing of a certain amount of the metal, to be limited by agreement, to the public for use in the arts. Of the proceeds of the sale, I will pay 10% to the government in consideration of its protection." "But," exclaimed President Boone, "that will make you the richest man who ever lived." "Undoubtedly," was the reply. "Why," added Mr. Boone, opening his eyes wider as the facts continued to dawn upon him, "you will become the financial dictator of the whole world." "Undoubtedly," again responded Dr. Six, unmoved. "That is what I propose to become. My discovery entitles me to no less. But, remember, I place myself under government inspection and restriction. I should not be allowed to flood the market, even if I were disposed to do so. But my own interest would restrain me. It is to my advantage that artemisium, once adopted, shall remain stable in value." A shadow of doubt suddenly crossed the president's face. "Suppose your secret is discovered," he said. "Surely your mine will not remain the only one. If you in so short a time have been able to accumulate an immense quantity of the new metal, it must be extremely abundant. Others will discover it, and then where shall we be?" While Mr. Boone uttered these words, those who were watching Dr. Six, as the president was not, resembled persons whose startled eyes are fixed upon a wild beast preparing to spring. As Mr. Boone ceased speaking, he turned towards the visitor, and instantly his lips fell apart and his face paled. Dr. Six had drawn himself up to his full stature, and his features were distorted with that peculiar mocking smile which had now returned with a concentrated expression of mingled self-confidence and disdain. "Will you have relief or not?" he asked in a dry, hard voice. "What can you do? I alone possess the secret which can restore industry and commerce. If you reject my offer, do you think a second one will come?" President Boone found voice to reply, stammeringly, "I did not mean to suggest a rejection of the offer. I only wished to inquire if you thought it probable that there would be no repetition of what occurred after gold was found at the South Pole." "The earth may be full of my metal," returned Dr. Six, almost fiercely, "but so long as I alone possess the knowledge how to extract it, is it of any more worth than common dirt? But come," he added, after a pause and softening his manner, "I have other schemes. Will you, as representatives of the leading nations, undertake the introduction of artemisium as a substitute for gold, or will you not?" "Can we not have time for deliberation?" asked President Boone. "Yes, 1 hour. Within that time I shall return to learn your decision," replied Dr. Six, rising and preparing to depart. "I leave these things," pointing to the tray, "in your keeping, and significantly, I trust your decision will be a wise one." His curious smile again curved his lips, and shot the ends of his mustache upward. And the influence of that smile remained in the room when he had closed the door behind him. The financiers gazed at one another for several minutes in silence. Then they turned towards the coruscating metal that filled the tray. End of chapter 2.
This recording is in the public domain.
The Moon Metal, Chapter 3. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. The Moon Metal by Garrett P. Service. Read by Betsy Bush in Marquette, Michigan, June 2007. Chapter 3. The Grand Teton Mine. Away on the western border of Wyoming, in the all but inaccessible heart of the Rocky Mountains, three mighty brothers, the Big Tetons, look perpendicularly into the blue eyes of Jenny's Lake, lying at the bottom of the profound depression among the mountains called Jackson's Hole. Bracing against one another for support, these remarkable peaks lift their granite spires from 12,000 to nearly 14,000 feet into the blue dome that arches the crest of the continent. Their sides, and especially those of their chief, the Grand Teton, are streaked with glaciers, which shine like silver trappings when the morning sun comes up above the wilderness of mountains stretching away eastward from the hole. When the first white men penetrated this wonderful region, and one of them bestowed his wife's name upon Jenny's Lake, they were intimidated by the Grand Teton. It made their flesh creep. Accustomed though they were to rough scrambling among mountain gorges and on the brows of immense precipices, when they glanced up at the face of the peak, where the cliffs fall one below another in a series of breathless descents, and imagined themselves clinging for dear life to those skyey battlements. But when, in 1872, Messrs. Stevenson and Langford finally reached the top of the Grand Teton, the only successful members of a party of 9 practice climbers who had started together from the bottom, they found there a little rectangular enclosure made by piling up rocks, 6 or 7 feet across and 3 feet in height, bearing evidences of great age, and indicating that the Red Indians had, for some unknown purpose, resorted to the summit of this tremendous peak long before the white men invaded their mountains. Yet neither the Indians nor the whites ever really conquered the Teton, for above the highest point that they attained rises a granite buttress, whose smooth vertical sides seem to them to defy everything but wings. Winding across the sage-covered floor of Jackson's Hole runs the Shoshone, or Snake River, which takes its rise from Jackson's Lake at the northern end of the basin, and then, as if shrinking from the threatening brows of the Tetons, whose fall would block its progress, makes a detour of 100 miles around the buttressed heights of the range before it finds a clear way across Idaho, and so on to the Columbia River and the Pacific Ocean. On a July morning, about a month after the visit of Dr. Max Six to the assembled financiers in New York, a party of 20 horsemen, following a mountain trail, arrived on the eastern margin of Jackson's Hole, and pausing upon a commanding eminence, with exclamations of wonder, glanced across the great depression where lay the shining coils of the Snake River at the towering forms of the Tetons, whose ice-striped cliffs flashed lightnings in the sunshine. Even the impassive broncos that the party rode lifted their heads inquiringly and snorted as if in equine astonishment at the magnificent spectacle. One familiar with the place would have noticed something which, to his mind, would have seemed more surprising than the pageantry of the mountains in their morning sunbath. Curling above one of the wild gorges that cut the lower slopes of the Tetons was a thick black smoke, which, when lifted by a passing breeze, obscured the precipices halfway to the summit of the peaks. Had the Grand Teton become a volcano? Certainly no hunting or exploring party could make a smoke like that. But a word from the leader of the party of horsemen explained the mystery.
"There is my mill, and the mine is underneath it."
The speaker was Dr. Six, and his companions were members of the Financial Congress. When he quitted their presence in New York, with the promise to return within an hour for their reply, he had no doubt in his mind what the reply would be. He knew they would accept his proposition, and they did. No time was then lost in communicating with the various governments, and arrangements were quickly perfected, whereby, in case the inspection of Dr. Six's mines and its resources proved satisfactory, America and Europe would unite in adopting the new metal as the basis of their coinage. As soon as this stage in the negotiations was reached, it only remained to send a committee of financiers and metallurgists, in company with Dr. Six, to the Rocky Mountains. They started under the doctor's guidance, completing the last stage of their journey on horseback. "An inspection of the records at Washington," Dr. Six continued, addressing the horsemen, "will show that I have filed a claim covering 10 acres of ground around the mouth of my mine. This was done as soon as I had discovered the metal. The filing of the claim and the subsequent proceedings which perfected my ownership attracted no attention, because everybody was thinking of the South Pole and its gold fields." The party gathered closer around Dr. Six and listened to his words with silent attention, while their horses rubbed noses and jingled their gold-mounted trappings. "As soon as I had legally protected myself," he continued, "I employed a force of men, transported my machinery and material across the mountains, erected my furnaces, and opened the mine. I was safe from intrusion, and even from idle curiosity, for the reason I have just mentioned. In fact, so exclusive was the attention of the new gold fields that I had difficulty in obtaining workmen. And finally I sent to Africa and engaged Negroes, whom I placed in charge of trustworthy foremen.
Accordingly, with half a dozen exceptions, you will see only black men in the mine. "And with their aid you have mined enough metal to supply the mints of the world?" asked President Boone. "Exactly so," was the reply. "But I no longer employ the large force which I needed at first. How much metal have you on hand? I am aware that you have already answered this question during our preliminary negotiations, but I ask it again for the benefit of some members of our party who were not present then." "I shall show you today," said Dr. Six, with his curious smile. 2,500 tons of refined artemisium stacked in rock-cut vaults under the Grand Teton. And you have dared to collect such inconceivable wealth in one place? You forget that it is not wealth until the people have learned to value it, and the governments have put their stamp upon it. True, but how did you arrive at the proper moment? Easily. I first ascertained that before the Antarctic discoveries the world contained altogether about 16,000 tons of gold, valued at $450,000 per ton, or $7,200,000,000 worth all told. Now my metal weighs, bulk for bulk, one quarter as much as gold. It might be reckoned at the same intrinsic value per ton, but I have considered it preferable to take advantage of the smaller weight of the new metal, which permits us to make coins of the same size as the old ones, but only one quarter as heavy, by giving to artemisium four times the value per ton that gold had. Thus only 4,000 tons of the new metal are required to supply the place of the 16,000 tons of gold. The 2,500 tons which I already have on hand are more than enough for coinage. The rest I can supply as fast as needed." The party did not wait for further explanations. They were eager to see the wonderful mine and the store of treasure. Spurs were applied, and they galloped down the steep trail, forded the Snake River, and, skirting the shore of Jenny's Lake, soon found themselves gazing up the headlong slopes and dizzy parapets of the Grand Teton. Dr. Six led them by a steep ascent to the mouth of the canyon, above one of whose walls stood his mill, and where the champ-champ of a powerful engine saluted their ears. End of chapter 3.
This recording is in the public domain.
The Moon Metal, Chapter 4. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. The Moon Metal by Garrett P. Service, read by Betsy Bush in Marquette, Michigan, June 2007. Chapter 4. The Wealth of the World. An electric light shot its penetrating rays into a gallery cut through virgin rock and running straight towards the heart of the Teton. The center of the gallery was occupied by a narrow railway, on which a few flat cars, propelled by electric power, passed to and fro. Black-skinned and silent workmen rode on the cars, both when they came, laden with broken masses of rock, from the farther end of the tunnel, and when they returned empty. Suddenly, to an eye situated a little way within the gallery, appeared at the entrance the dark face of Dr. Six, wearing its most discomposing smile, and a moment later the broader countenance of President Boone loomed in the electric glare beside the doctor's black framework of eyebrows and mustache. Behind them was grouped the other visiting financiers. "This tunnel," said Dr. Six, "leads to the mine head, where the ore-bearing rock is blasted." As he spoke, a hollow roar issued from the depth of the mountain, followed in a short time by a gust of foul air. "You probably will not care to go in there," said the doctor, "and in fact it is very uncomfortable. But we shall follow the next carload to the smelter, and you can witness the reduction of the ore." Accordingly, when another car came rumbling out of the tunnel with its load of cracked rock, they all accompanied it into an adjoining apartment, where it was cast into a metallic chute through which, they were informed, it reached the furnace. "While it is melting," explained Dr. Six, "certain elements, the nature of which I must beg to keep secret, are mixed with the ore, causing chemical action which results in the extraction of the metal. Now let me show you pure artemisium issuing from the furnace." He led the visitors through two apartments into a third, one side of which was walled by the front of a furnace. From this projected two or three small spouts, and iridescent streams of molten metal fell from the spouts into earthen receptacles from which the blazing liquid was led, like flowing iron, into a system of molds, where it was allowed to cool and harden. The financiers looked on wondering, and their astonishment grew when they were conducted into the rock-cut storerooms beneath, where they saw metallic ingots glowing like gigantic opals in the light which Dr. Six turned on. They were piled in rows along the walls as high as a man could reach. A very brief inspection sufficed to convince the visitors that Dr. Six was able to perform all that he promised. Although they had not penetrated the secret of his process of reducing the ore, yet they had seen the metal flowing from the furnace, and the piles of ingots proved conclusively that he had uttered no vain boast when he said he could give the world a new coinage. But President Boone, being himself a metallurgist, desired to inspect the mysterious ore a little more closely. Possibly he was thinking that if another mine was destined to be discovered, he might as well be the discoverer as anybody. Dr. Six attempted no concealment, but his smile became more than usually scornful as he stopped a laden car and invited the visitors to help themselves. "I think," he said, "that I have struck the only lode of this ore in the Teton, or possibly in this part of the world, but I don't know for certain. There may be plenty of it only waiting to be found. That, however, doesn't trouble me. The great point is that nobody except myself knows how to extract the metal." Mr. Boone closely examined the chunk of rock which he had taken from the car. Then he pulled a lens from his pocket with a deprecatory glance at Dr. Six. "Oh, that's all right," said the latter with a laugh, the first that these gentlemen had ever heard from his lips, and it almost made them shudder. "Put it to every test, examine it with the microscope, with fire, with electricity, with the spectroscope, in every way you can think of. I assure you it is worth your while." Again Dr. Six uttered his freezing laugh, passing into the familiar smile, which had now become an undisguised mock. "Upon my word," said Mr. Boone, taking his eye from the lens, "I see no sign of any metal here." "Look at the green specks," cried the doctor, snatching the specimen from the president's hand. "That's it. That's artemisium. But it's of no use unless you can get it out and purify it, which is my secret." For the third time, Dr. Six laughed, and his merriment affected the visitors so disagreeably that they showed impatience to be gone. Immediately he changed his manner. "Come into my office," he said, with a return to the graciousness which had characterized him ever since the party started from New York. When they were all seated and the doctor had handed round a box of cigars, he resumed the conversation in his most amiable manner. "You see, gentlemen," he said, turning a piece of ore in his fingers, "artemisium is like aluminum. It can only be obtained in the metallic form by a special process, while these greenish particles, which you may perhaps mistake for chrysolite, or some similar unisilicate, really contain the precious metal. They are not entirely composed of it. The process by which I separate out the metallic element, while the ore is passing through the furnace, is, in truth, quite simple, and its very simplicity guards my secret. Make your minds easy as to overproduction. A man is as likely to jump over the moon as to find me out. But," he continued, again changing his manner, "we have had business enough for one day. Now for a little recreation." While speaking, the doctor pressed a button on his desk, and the room, which was illuminated by electric lamps, for there were no windows in the building, suddenly became dark, except part of one wall, where a broad area of light appeared. Dr. Six's voice had become very soothing when next he spoke. "I am fond of amusing myself with the peculiar form of the magic lantern, which I invented some years ago, and which I have never exhibited except for the entertainment of my friends. The pictures will appear upon the wall, the apparatus being concealed." He had hardly ceased speaking when the illuminated space seemed to melt away, leaving a great opening, through which the spectators looked as if into another world on the opposite side of the wall. For a minute or two they could not clearly discern what was presented. Then gradually the flitting scenes and figures became more distinct, until the lifelikeness of the spectacle absorbed their whole attention. Before them passed, in panoramic review, a sunny land, filled with brilliant-hued vegetation, and dotted with villages and cities, which were bright with light-colored buildings. People appeared moving through the scenes, as in a cinematograph exhibition, but with infinitely more semblance of reality. In fact, the pictures, blending one into another, seemed to be life itself. Yet it was not an earth-like scene. The colors of the passing landscape were such as no man in the room had ever beheld, and the people, tall, round-limbed, with florid complexion, golden hair, and brilliant eyes and lips, were indescribably beautiful and graceful in all their movements. From the land the view passed out to sea, and bright blue waves, edged with creaming foam, ran swiftly under the spectators' eyes, and occasionally, driven before light winds, appeared fleets of daintily shaped vessels, which reminded the beholder, by their flashing wings, of the feigned Ship of Pearl. After the fairy ships and breezy sea views came along, curving line of coast, brilliant with coral sands, and indented by frequent bays, along whose enchanting shores lay pleasant towns, the landscapes behind them splendid with groves, meadows, and streams. Presently, the shifting photographic tape, or whatever the mechanism may have been, appeared to have settled upon a chosen scene, and there it rested. A broad champaign reached away to distant sapphire mountains, while the foreground was occupied by a magnificent house resembling a large country villa, fronted with a garden shaded by bowers and festoons of huge, brilliant flowers. Birds of radiant plumage flitted among the trees and blossoms, and then appeared a company of gaily attired people, including many young girls, who joined hands and danced in a ring, apparently with shouts of laughter, while a group of musicians standing near thrummed and blew upon curiously shaped instruments. Suddenly the shadow of a dense cloud flitted across the scene, whereupon the brilliant birds flew away with screams of terror, which almost seemed to reach the ears of the onlookers through the wall. An expression of horror came over the faces of the people. The children broke from their merry circle and ran for protection to their elders. The utmost confusing and whelming terror were evidenced for a moment. Then the ground split asunder, and the house and the garden, with all their living occupants, were swallowed by an awful chasm, which opened just where they had stood. The great rent ran in a widening line across the sunlit landscape until it reached the horizon. When the distant mountains crumbled, clouds poured in from all sides at once, and billows of flame burst through them as they veiled the scene. But in another instant the commotion was over, and the world, whose curious spectacles had been enacted as if on the other side of a window, seemed to retreat swiftly into space, until at last, emerging from a fleecy cloud, it reappeared in the form of the full moon hanging in the sky, but larger than is its wont, with its dry ocean beds, its keen-spired peaks, its ragged mountain ranges, its gaping chasms, its immense crater rings, and Tycho, the chief of them all, shooting ray-like streaks across the scarred face of the abandoned lunar globe. The show was ended, and Dr. Six, turning on only a partial illumination in the room, rose slowly to his feet, his tall form appearing strangely magnified in the gloom, and invited his bewildered guests to accompany him to his house outside the mill, where he said dinner awaited them. As they emerged into daylight, they acted like persons just aroused from an opiate dream. End of chapter 4.
This recording is in the public domain.
The Moon Metal, Chapter 5. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Read by Betsy Bush in Marquette, Michigan, June 2007. The Moon Metal by Garrett P. Service. Chapter 5. Wonders of the New Metal. Within a 12-month after the visit of President Boone and his fellow financiers to the mine of the Grand Teton, a railway had been constructed from Jackson's Hole, connecting with one of the Pacific lines, and the distribution of the new metal was begun. All of Dr. Six's terms had been accepted. United States troops occupied a permanent encampment on the upper waters of the Snake River to afford protection, and as the consignments of precious ingots were hurried east and west on guarded trains, the mints all over the world resumed their activity. Once more, a common monetary standard prevailed, and commerce revived as if touched by a magic wand. Artemisium quickly won its way in popular favor. Its matchless beauty alone was enough. Not only was it gladly accepted in the form of money, but its success was instantaneous in the arts. Dr. Six and the inspectors representing the various nations found it difficult to limit the output to the agreed-upon amount. The demand was incessant. Goldsmiths and jewelers continually discovered new excellences in the wonderful metal. Its properties of translucence and refraction enabled skillful artists to perform marvels. By suitable management, a chain of artemisium could be made to resemble a string of varicolored gems, each separate link having a tint of its own, while as the wearer moved, delicate complementary colors chased one another in rapid undulation from end to end. A fresh charm was added by the new metal to the personal adornment of women, and an enhanced splendor to the pageants of society. Gold, in its palmiest days, had never enjoyed such a vogue. A crowded reception room or a dinner party, where artemisium abounded, possessed an indescribable atmosphere of luxury and richness, refined in quality, yet captivating to every sense. Imaginative persons went so far as to aver that the sight and presence of the metal exercised a strangely soothing and dreamy power over the mind, like the influence of moonlight streaming through the treetops on a still, balmy night. The public curiosity in regard to the origin of artemisium was boundless. The various nations published official bulletins in which the general facts, omitting, of course, such incidents as the singular exhibition seen by the visiting financiers on the wall of Dr. Six's office, were detailed to gratify the universal desire for information. President Boone not only submitted the specimens of ore-bearing rock which he had brought from the mine to careful analysis, but also appealed to several of the greatest living chemists and mineralogists to aid him. But they were all equally mystified. The green substance contained in the ore, although differing slightly from ordinary chrysolite, answered all the known tests of that mineral. It was remembered, however, that Dr. Six had said that they would be likely to mistake the substance for chrysolite, and the result of their experiments justified his prediction. Evidently, the doctor had gone a stone's cast beyond the chemistry of the day, and just as evidently, he did not mean to reveal his discovery for the benefit of science, nor for the benefit of any pockets except his own. Notwithstanding the failure of the chemist to extract anything from Dr. Six's ore, the public at large never doubted that the secret would be discovered in good time, and thousands of prospectors flocked to the Teton Mountains in search of the ore, and without much difficulty they found it. Evidently, the doctor had been mistaken in thinking that his mine might be the only one. The new miners hurried specimens of the green-speckled rock to the chemical laboratories for experimentation, and meanwhile began to lay up stores of the ore in anticipation of the time when the proper way to extract the metal should be discovered. But alas, that time did not come. The fresh ore proved to be as refractory as that which had been obtained from Dr. Six. But in the midst of the universal disappointment there came a new sensation. One morning the newspapers glared with a dispatch from Grand Teton Station announcing that the metal itself had been discovered by prospectors on the eastern slope of the main peak. "It outcrops in many places," ran the dispatch, "and many small nuggets have been picked out of crevices in the rocks." The excitement produced by this news was even greater than when gold was discovered at the South Pole. Again, a mad rush was made for the Tetons. The heights around Jackson's Hole and the shores of Jackson's and Jenny's Lakes were quickly dotted with camps, and the military force had to be doubled to keep off the curious and occasionally menacing crowds which gathered in the vicinity and seemed bent on unearthing the great secret locked behind the windowless walls of the mill, where the column of black smoke and the roar of the engine served as reminders of the incredible wealth which the sole possessor of that secret was rolling up. This time no mistake had been made. It was a fact that the metal, in virgin purity, had been discovered scattered in various places on the ledges of the Grand Teton. In a little while thousands had obtained specimens with their own hands. The quantity was distressingly small, considering the number and the eagerness of the seekers, but that it was genuine artemisium not even Dr. Six could have denied. He, however, made no attempt to deny it. "Yes," he said when questioned, "I find that I have been deceived. At first I thought the metal existed only in the form of the green ore, but of late I have come upon veins of pure artemisium in my mine. I am glad for your sakes, but sorry for my own. Still, it may turn out that there is no great amount of free artemisium after all." While the doctor talked in this manner, close observers detected a lurking sneer which his acquaintances had not noticed since artemisium was first adopted as the money basis of the world. The crowd that swarmed upon the mountain quickly exhausted all of the visible supply of the metal. Sometimes they found it in a thin stratum at the bottom of crevices, where it could be detached in opalescent plates and leaves of the thickness of paper. These superficial deposits evidently might have been formed from water holding the metal in solution. Occasionally, deep cracks contained nuggets and wiry masses which looked as if they had run together when molten. The most promising spots were soon staked out in miners' claims, machinery was procured, stock companies were formed, and borings were begun. The enthusiasm arising from the earlier finds and the flattering surface indications caused everybody to work with feverish haste and energy. And within 2 months, 100 tunnels were piercing the mountain. For a long time nobody was willing to admit the truth, which gradually forced itself upon the attention of the miners. The deeper they went, the scarcer became the indications of artemisium. In fact, such deposits as were found were confined to fissures near the surface. But Dr. Six continued to report a surprising increase in the amount of free metal in his mine, and this encouraged all who had not exhausted their capital to push on their tunnels in the hope of finally striking a vein. At length, however, the smaller operators gave up in despair, until only one heavily capitalized company remained at work. End of chapter 5.
This recording is in the public domain.
The Moon Metal, Chapter 6. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. The Moon Metal, by Garrett P. Service. Chapter 6. A Strange Discovery.
It is my belief that Dr. Max Six is a deceiver.
The person who uttered this opinion was a young engineer, Andrew Hall, who had charge of the operations of one of the mining companies which were driving tunnels into the Grand Teton.
"What do you mean by that?" asked President Boone, who was the principal backer of the enterprise.
"I mean," replied Hall, "that there is no free metal in this mountain, and Dr. Six knows there is none."
"But he is getting it himself from his mine," retorted President Boone.
"So he says, but who has seen it? No one is admitted into the Six mine. His foremen are forbidden to talk, and his workmen are specially imported Negroes, who do not understand the English language."
"But," persisted Mr. Boone, "how then do you account for the nuggets scattered over the mountain? And beside, what object could Dr. Six have in pretending that there is free metal to be had for the digging?"
"He may have salted the mountain, for all I know," said Hall. "As for his object, I confess I am entirely in the dark. But for all that, I am convinced that we shall find no more metal if we dig 10 miles for it."
"Nonsense," said the President. "If we keep on, we shall strike it. Did not Dr. Six himself admit that he found no free artemisium until his tunnel had reached the core of the peak? We must go as deep as he has gone before we give up." I fear the depths he attains are beyond most people's reach, was Hall's answer, while a thoughtful look crossed his clear-cut brow. But since you desire it, of course the work shall go on. I should like, however, to change the direction of the tunnel.
Certainly, replied Mr. Boone, bore in whatever direction you think proper. Only don't despair.
After a month after the conversation, Andrew Hall, with whom a community of tastes in many things had made me intimately acquainted, asked me one morning to accompany him into his tunnel. I want to have a trusty friend at my elbow, he said, for unless I am a dreamer, something remarkable will happen within the next hour, and two witnesses are better than one. I knew Hall was not the person to make such a remark carelessly, and my curiosity was intensely excited, but knowing his peculiarities, I did not press him for an explanation. When we arrived at the head of the tunnel, I was surprised at finding no workmen there. "I stopped blasting some time ago," said Hall, in explanation, "for a reason which, I hope, will become evident to you very soon. Lately I have been boring very slowly, and yesterday I paid off the men and dismissed them with the announcement, which I am confident President Boone will sanction, after he hears my report of this morning's work, that the tunnel is abandoned. You see, I am now using a drill which I can manage without assistance. I believe the work is almost completed, and I want you to witness the end of it." He then carefully applied the drill, which noiselessly screwed its nose into the rock. When it had sunk to a depth of a few inches, he withdrew it, and taking a hand-drill capable of making a hole not more than an eighth of an inch in diameter, cautiously began boring in the center of the larger cavity. He had made hardly 100 turns of the handle when the drill shot through the rock. A gratified smile illuminated his features, and he said in a suppressed voice, "Don't be alarmed. I'm going to put out the light." Instantly we were in complete darkness, but being close to Hall's side I could detect his movements. He pulled out the drill, and for half a minute remained motionless as if listening. There was no sound. "I must enlarge the opening," he whispered, and immediately the faint grating of a sharp tool cutting through the rock informed me of his progress. "There," at last he said, "I think that will do. Now for a look." I could tell that he had placed his eye at the hole and was gazing with breathless attention. Presently he pulled my sleeve. "Put your eye there," he whispered, pushing me into the proper position for looking through the hole. At first I could discern nothing except a smoky blue glow, but soon my vision cleared a little, and then I perceived that I was gazing into a narrow tunnel which met ours directly end to end. Glancing along the axis of this gallery, I saw, some 200 yards away, a faint light which evidently indicated the mouth of the tunnel. At the end where we had met at the mysterious tunnel was considerably widened at one side, as if the excavators had started to change direction and then abandoned the work. And in this elbow I could just see the outlines of two or three flat cars loaded with broken stone, while a heap of the same material lay near them. Through the center of the tunnel ran a railway track.
"Do you know what you are looking at?" asked Hall in my ear.
"I begin to suspect," I replied, "that you have accidentally run into Dr. Six's mine. If Dr. Six had been on his guard, this accident wouldn't have happened," replied Hall, with an almost inaudible chuckle.
"I heard you remark a month ago," I said, "that you were changing the direction of your tunnel. Had this been the aim of your labors ever since?"
"You have hit it," he replied. "Long ago I became convinced that my company was throwing away its money in a vain attempt to strike a lode of pure artemisium. But President Boone has great faith in Dr. Six and would not give up the work. So I adopted what I regarded as the only practicable method of proving the truth of my opinion and saving the company's funds. An electric indicator of my invention enabled me to locate the sixth tunnel when I got near it, and I have met it end-on, and opened this peephole in order to observe the doctor's operations. I feel that such spying is entirely justified in the circumstances, although I cannot yet explain just how or why I feel sure that Dr. Six was the cause of the sudden discovery of the surface nuggets, and that he has encouraged the miners for his own ends, until he has brought ruin to thousands who have spent their last cent in driving useless tunnels into this mountain. It is a righteous thing to expose him."
"But," I interposed,
I do not see that you have exposed anything yet except the interior of a tunnel. You will see more clearly after a while, was the reply. Hall now placed his eye again at the aperture, and was unable entirely to repress the exclamation that rose to his lips. He remained staring through the hole for several minutes, without uttering a word. Presently, I noticed that the lenses of his eye were illuminated by a ray of light coming through the hole, but he did not stir. After a long inspection, he suddenly applied his ear to the hole and listened intently for at least 5 minutes. Not a sound was audible to me, but by an occasional pressure of the hand, Hall signified that some important disclosure was reaching his sense of hearing. At length, he removed his ear. "Pardon me," he whispered, "for keeping you so long in waiting, but what I have just seen and overheard was of a nature to admit of no interruption. He is still talking, and by pressing your ear against the hole you may be able to catch what he says." "Who is he?" "Look for yourself." I placed my eye at the aperture, and almost recoiled with the violence of my surprise. The tunnel before me was brilliantly illuminated, and within 3 feet of the wall of rock behind which we crouched stood Dr. Six, his dark profile looking almost satanic in the sharp contrast of light and shadow. He was talking to one of his foremen, and the two were the only visible occupants of the tunnel. Putting my ear to the little opening, I heard his words distinctly. "End of your rope. Well, you've spent a pretty lot of money for their experience, and I rather think we shall not be troubled again by artemisium seekers for some time to come." The doctor's voice ceased, and instantly I clapped my eye to the hole. He had changed his position so that his black eyes now looked straight at the aperture. My heart was in my mouth, for at first I believed from his expression that he had detected the gleam of my eyeball. But if so, he probably mistook it for a bit of mica in the rock, and paid no further attention. Then his lips moved, and I put my ear again to the hole. He seemed to be replying to a question that the foreman had asked. "If they do," he said, "they will never guess the real secret." Thereupon he turned on his heel, kicked a bit of rock off the track, and strode away towards the entrance. The foreman paused long enough to turn out the electric lamp, and then followed the doctor. "Well?" asked Hall. "What have you heard?" I told him everything. "It fully corroborates the evidence of my own eyes and ears," he remarked, "and we may count ourselves extremely lucky. It is not likely that Dr. Six will be heard on a second time proclaiming his deception with his own lips. It is plain that he was led to talk as he did to the foreman on account of the latter's having informed him of the sudden discharge of my men this morning. Their presence within earshot of our hiding-place during their conversation was, of course, pure accident, and so you can see how kind fortune has been to us. I expected to have to watch and listen and form deductions for a week at least, before getting the information which 5 lucky minutes have placed in our hands." While he was speaking, my companion busied himself in carefully plugging up the hole in the rock. When it was closed to his satisfaction, he turned on the light in our tunnel. "Did you observe," he asked, "that there was a second tunnel?" "What do you say?" "When the light was on in there, I saw the mouth of a smaller tunnel, entering the main one behind the cars on the right. Did you notice it?" "Oh, yes," I replied. "I did observe some kind of a dark hole there, but I paid no attention to it because I was so absorbed in the doctor." "Well," rejoined Hall, smiling, "it was worth considerably more than a glance. As a subject of thought, I find it even more absorbing than Dr. Six. Did you see the track in it?" "No," I had to acknowledge. "I did not notice that, but," I continued, a little piqued by his manner, "being a branch of the main tunnel, I don't see anything remarkable in its having a track also." "It was rather dim in that hole," said Hall, still smiling in a somewhat provoking way, "but the railroad track was there plain enough, and whether you think it remarkable or not, I should like to lay you a wager that that track leads to a secret worth a dozen of the one we have just overheard." "My good friend," I retorted, still smarting a little, "I shall not presume to match my stupidity against your perspicacity. I haven't cat's eyes in the dark." Hall immediately broke out laughing, and slapping me good-naturedly on the shoulder, exclaimed, "Come, come now, if you go to kicking back at a fellow like that, I shall be sorry I ever undertook this adventure." End of chapter 6.
This recording is in the public domain.
The Moon Metal.
Chapter 7.
This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Read by Betsy Bush in Marquette, Michigan, June 2007. The Moon Metal by Garrett P. Service.
Chapter 7. A Mystery Indeed. When President Boone had heard our story, he promptly approved Hall's dismissal of the men. He expressed great surprise that Dr. Six should have resorted to a deception which had been so disastrous to innocent people, and at first he talked of legal proceedings. But after thinking the matter over, he concluded that Six was too powerful to be attacked with success, especially when the only evidence against him was that he had claimed to find artemisium in his mind at a time when, as everybody knew, artemisium actually was found outside the mine. There was no apparent motive for the deception, and no proof of malicious intent. In short, Mr. Boone decided that the best thing for him and his stockholders to do was to keep silent about their losses and await events. And at Hall's suggestion, he also determined to say nothing to anybody about the discovery we had made. "It could do no good," said Hall in making the suggestion, "and it might spoil a plan I have in mind." "What plan?" asked the president. "I prefer not to tell just yet," was the reply. I observed that, in our interview with Mr. Boone, Hall made no reference to the side tunnel to which he had appeared to attach so much importance, and I concluded that he now regarded it as lacking significance. In this I was mistaken. A few days afterwards I received an invitation from Hall to accompany him once more into the abandoned tunnel. "I have found out what that sidetrack means," he said, "and it has plunged me into another mystery so dark and profound that I cannot see my way through it. I must beg you to say no word to anyone concerning the things I am about to show you." I gave the required promise, and we entered the tunnel, which nobody had visited since our former adventure. Having extinguished our lamp, my companion opened the peephole, and a thin ray of light streamed through the tunnel on the opposite side of the wall. He applied his eye to the hole. "Yes," he said, quickly stepping back and pushing me into his place, "they are still at it. Look and tell me what you see." "I see," I replied, after placing my eye at the aperture, "a gang of men unloading a car, which has just come out of the side tunnel, and putting its contents upon another car standing on the track of the main tunnel." "Yes, and what are they handling?" "Why, ore, of course." "And do you see nothing significant in that?" "To be sure," I exclaimed. "Why, that ore—" "Hush, hush," admonished Hall, putting his hand over my mouth. "Don't talk so loud. Now go on in a whisper." "The ore," I resumed, "may have come back from the furnace room, because the side tunnel turns off so as to run parallel with the other." "It not only may have come back, it actually has come back," said Hall. "How can you be sure?" "Because I have been over the track, and know that it leads to a secret apartment directly under the furnace in which Dr. Six pretends to melt the ore." For a minute after hearing this avowal, I was speechless. "Are you serious?" I asked at length. "Perfectly serious. Run your finger along the rock here. Do you perceive a seam? 2 days ago, after seeing what you have just witnessed in the sixth tunnel, I carefully cut out a section of the wall, making an aperture large enough to crawl through, and when I knew the workmen were asleep, I crept in there and examined both tunnels from end to end. But in solving one mystery, I have run myself into another infinitely more perplexing." "How is that?" "Why does Dr. Six take such elaborate pains to deceive his visitors, and also the government officers? It is now plain that he conducts no mining operations whatever. This mine of his is a gigantic blind. Whenever inspectors or scientific curiosity-seekers visit his mill, his mute workmen assume the air of being very busy. The cars laden with his so-called ore rumble out of the tunnel, and their contents are ostentatiously poured into the furnace, or appear to be poured into it, really dropping into a receptacle beneath to be carried back into the mine again. And then the doctor leads his gulled visitors around to the other side of the furnace and shows them the molten metal coming out in streams. Now what does it all mean? That's what I'd like to find out. What's his game? For mark you, if he doesn't get artemisium from this pretended ore, he gets it from some other source, and right on this spot, too. There is no doubt about that. The whole world is supplied by Six's furnace, and Six feeds his furnace with something that comes from his 10 acres of Grand Teton Rock. What is that something? How does he get it, and where does he hide it? These are the things I should like to find out. Well, I replied, I fear I can't help you. But the difference between you and me, he retorted, is that you can go to sleep over it, while I shall never get another good night's rest so long as this black mystery remains unsolved. What will you do? I don't know exactly what, but I've got a dim idea which may take shape after a while. Hall was silent for some time. Then he suddenly asked, Did you ever hear of that queer magic lantern show with which Dr. Six entertained Mr. Boone and the members of the Financial Commission in the early days of the artemisium business? Yes, I've heard the story, but I don't think it was ever made public. The newspapers never got hold of it. No, I believe not. Odd thing, wasn't it? Why, yes, very odd. But just like the doctor's eccentric ways, though, he's always doing something to astonish somebody, without any apparent earthly reason. But what put you in mind of that? Free artemisium put me in mind of it, replied Hall quizzically. I don't see the connection. I'm not sure that I do either, but when you are dealing with Dr. Six, nothing is too improbable to be thought of. Hall thereupon fell to musing again, while we returned to the entrance of the tunnel. After he had made everything secure and slipped the key into his pocket, my companion remarked, Don't you think it would be best to keep this latest discovery to ourselves? Certainly. Because, he continued, nobody would be benefited just now by knowing what we know, and to expose the worthlessness of the ore might cause a panic. The public is a queer animal, and never gets scared at just the thing you expect will alarm it, but always at something else. We had shaken hands and were separating when Hall stopped me. Do you believe in alchemy? He asked. That's an odd question from you, I replied. I thought alchemy was exploded long ago. Well, he said slowly, I suppose it has been exploded, but then, you know, an explosion may sometimes be a kind of instantaneous education, breaking up old things but revealing new ones. End of chapter 7.
This recording is in the public domain.
The Moon Metal, Chapter 8. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Read by Betsy Bush, in Marquette, Michigan, June 2007. The Moon Metal, by Garrett P. Service.
Chapter 8. More of Dr. Six's Magic. Important business called me east soon after the meeting with Hall described in the foregoing chapter, and before I again saw the Grand Teton, very stirring events had taken place. As the reader is aware, Dr. Six's agreement with the various governments limited the output of his mine. An international commission, continually in session in New York, adjusted the differences arising among the nations concerning financial affairs, and allotted to each the proper amount of artemisium for coinage. Of course, this amount varied from time to time, but a fair average could easily be maintained. The gradual increase of wealth in houses, machinery, manufactured and artistic products called for a corresponding increase in the circulating medium, but this too was easily provided for. An equally painstaking supervision was exercised over the amount of the precious metal which Dr. Six was permitted to supply to the markets for use in the arts. On this side also, the demand gradually increased, but the wonderful Teton mine seemed equal to all calls upon its resources. After the failure of the mining operations, there was a moderate revival of the efforts to reduce the Teton ore, but no success cheered the experimenters. Prospectors also wandered all over the earth looking for pure artemisium, but in vain. The general public, knowing nothing of what Hall had discovered,
and still believing Six's story that he also had found pure artemisium in his mine, accounted for the failure of the tunneling operations on the supposition that the metal, in a free state, was excessively rare, and that Dr. Six had had the luck to strike the only vein of it that the Grand Teton contained. As if to give countenance to this opinion, Dr. Six now announced, in the most public manner, that he had been deceived again, and that the vein of free metal he had struck being exhausted, no other had appeared. Accordingly, he said, he must henceforth rely exclusively, as in the beginning, upon reduction of the ore. Artemisium had proved itself an immense boon to mankind, and the new era of commercial prosperity which it had ushered in already exceeded everything that the world had known in the past. Schoolchildren learned that human civilization had taken five great strides, known respectively beginning at the bottom, as the Age of Stone, the Age of Bronze, the Age of Iron, the Age of Gold, and the Age of Artemisium. Nevertheless, sources of dissatisfaction finally began to appear, and after the nature of such things, they developed with marvelous rapidity. People began to grumble about contraction of the currency. In every country there arose a party which demanded free money. Demagogues pointed to the brief reign of paper money after the demonetization of gold as a happy period, when the people had enjoyed their rights, and the money barons, borrowing a term from 19th-century history, were kept at bay. Then came denunciations of the International Commission for Restricting the Coinage. Dr. Six was described as a devilfish, sucking the veins of the planet and holding it helpless in the grasp of his tentacular billions. In the United States, meetings of agitators passed furious resolutions denouncing the government, assailing the rich, cursing Dr. Six, and calling upon the oppressed to rise and take their own. The final outcome was, of course, violence. Mobs had to be suppressed by military force, but the most dramatic scene in the tragedy occurred at the Grand Teton. Excited by inflammatory speeches and printed documents, several thousand armed men assembled in the neighborhood of Jenny's Lake and prepared to attack the Six Mine. For some reason, the military guard had been depleted, and the mob, under the leadership of a man named Bings, who showed no little talent as a commander and strategist, surprised the small force of soldiers and locked them up in their own guardhouse. Telegraphic communication having been cut off by the astute Bings, a fierce attack was made on the mine. The assailants swarmed up the sides of the canyon and attempted to break in through the foundation of the buildings, but the masonry was stronger than they had anticipated, and the attack failed. Sharpshooters then climbed the neighboring heights and kept up an incessant peppering of the walls with conical bullets driven at 4,000 feet per second. No reply came from the gloomy structure. The huge column of black smoke rose uninterruptedly into the sky, and the noise of the great engine never ceased for an instant. The mob gathered closer on all sides and redoubled the fire of the rifles, to which was now added the belching of several machine guns. Ragged holes began to appear in the walls, and at the sight of these the assailants yelled with delight. It was evident that the mill could not long withstand so destructive a bombardment. If the besiegers had possessed artillery, they would have knocked the buildings into splinters within 20 minutes. As it was, they would need a whole day to win their victory. Suddenly it became evident that the besieged were about to take a hand in the fight. Thus far they had not shown themselves or fired a shot, but now a movement was perceived on the roof, and the projecting arms of some kind of machinery became visible. Many marksmen concentrated their fire upon the mysterious objects, but apparently with little effect. Bings mounted on a rock, so as to command a clear view of the field, was on the point of ordering a party to rush forward with axes and beat down the formidable doors, when there came a blinding flash from the roof. Something swished through the air, and a gust of heat met the assailants in the face. Bings dropped dead from his perch, and then, as if the scythe of the destroyer had swung downward, and to right and left in quick succession, the close-packed mob was leveled, rank after rank, until the few survivors crept behind rocks for refuge. Instantly, the atmospheric broom swept up and down the canyon and across the mountain's flanks, and the marksmen fell in bunches like shaken grapes. 9/10 of the besiegers were destroyed within 10 minutes, after the first movement had been noticed on the roof. Those who survived owed their escape to the rocks which concealed them, and they lost no time in crawling off into neighboring chasms, and as soon as they were beyond eyeshot from the mill, they fled with panic speed. Then the towering form of Dr. Six appeared at the door, emerging without sign of fear or excitement. He picked his way among his fallen enemies, and approaching the military guardhouse, undid the fastening and set the imprisoned soldiers free. "I think I am paying rather dear for my whistle," he said, with a characteristic sneer, to Captain Carter, the commander of the troop. "It seems that I must not only defend my own people and property when attacked by mob force, but must also come to the rescue of the soldiers, whose payrolls are met from my pocket." The captain made no reply, and Dr. Six strode back to the works. When the released soldiers saw what had occurred, their amazement had no bounds. It was necessary at once to dispose of the dead, and this was no easy undertaking for their small force. However, they accomplished it, and at the beginning of their work made a most surprising discovery. "How's this, Jim?" said one of the men to his comrade, as they stooped to lift the nearest victim of Dr. Six's withering fire. "What's this fellow got all over him?" "Artemisium, 'pon my soul," responded Jim, staring at the body. "He's all coated over with it." Immediately from all sides came similar exclamations. Every man who had fallen was covered with a film of the precious metal, as if he had been dipped into an electrolytic bath. Clothing seemed to have been charred, and the metallic atoms had penetrated the flesh of the victims. The rocks all round the battlefield were similarly veneered. "It looks to me," said Captain Carter, "as if old Six had turned one of his spouts of artemisium into a hose-pipe and soaked 'em with it." "That's it," chimed in a lieutenant. "That's exactly what he's done." "Well," returned the captain, "if he can do that, I don't see what use he's got for us here." "Probably he don't want to waste the stuff," said the lieutenant. "What do you suppose it cost him to plate this crowd?" "I guess a month's pay for the whole troop wouldn't cover the expense. It's costly, but then, gracious, wouldn't I have given something for the doctor's hose when I was a youngster campaigning in the Philippines in 99? The story of the marvelous way in which Dr. Six defended his mill became the sensation of the world for many days. The hose-pipe theory, struck off on the spot by Captain Carter, seized the popular fancy, and was generally accepted without further question. There was an element of the ludicrous which robbed the tragedy of some of its horror. Moreover, no one could deny that Dr. Six was well within his rights in defending himself by any means when so savagely attacked, and his triumphant success, no less than the ingenuity which was supposed to underlie it, placed him in a heroic light which he had not hitherto enjoyed. As to the demagogues, who were responsible for the outbreak and its terrible consequences, they slunk out of the public eye, and the result of the battle at the mine seemed to have been a clearing up of the atmosphere, such as a thunderstorm effects at the close of a season of foul weather. But now, little as men guessed it, the beginning of the end was close at hand. End of chapter 8.
This recording is in the public domain.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal.
All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.